Up next, we're going to talk about cinema symbolism, too. That's right. What is going on in our popular movies? What are the messages there? Some of them hidden, some of them maybe not. Robert W. Sullivan IV joins us. He's back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. You are going to enjoy the next couple hours. Robert Sullivan IV, philosopher, historian, theologian, writer, lawyer. He had his Bachelor of Arts degree from the Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania, and then spending his entire junior year studying European history at St. Catherine's College in Oxford University. He received his Juris Doctor's degree from the Widener University of the Delaware campus back in 2000. He has studied international law. He's done it all, and he is also a Freemason. Welcome back to the program, Robert.
Hey, George, thanks for having me back on Coast to Coast AM. Much appreciated. Great to be with you tonight, and looking forward to tonight's show.
Me too. Now, when people hear the word Freemason, they freak. How come?
Oh, they shouldn't. I guess because it, you know, going back, it's the oldest, you know, one of the largest and oldest fraternities in the world. A lot of conspiracy surrounds it. Some of it is rooted in reality. Some of it is not. Certainly when you get into the founding of the United States, there is a lot of Masonic influence. And certainly with the architecture, that's pretty irrefutable. I talk about this in my first book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, but yeah, it can scare some people. I've been involved with it for 20 years now, and, I've never really seen a lot of the stuff that some people talk about. But everything casts a shadow in this world. And, like I said, yeah, a lot of conspiracy definitely surrounds it. Very powerful, very influential.
Weren't most original U.S. presidents Freemasons?
Well, a lot of the founders were. You get into like George Washington was and Benjamin Franklin. Adams was not. Jefferson is 50-50 on.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not, but there is some question with that. But a lot of the founders were. You have a lot of Masonic influence, the triple division of government, for instance, in the United States. That comes from Blue Lodge Freemasonry, the triple division of governance in the Blue Lodge. So you do have a very heavy Masonic influence. And, of course, you can find it in the architecture in places like Washington, D.C., and you get into things like the Erie Canal construction was Freemasonic. Union College of Schenectady, New York is Freemasonic. It really goes in depth, and it's there. I mean, no question about it.
Let's talk a little bit. And when you were with me, we talked about the Royal Arch of Enoch back a couple years ago.
That's right.
Let's talk about the new ones, Cinema Symbolism 2, of course. Tell me, give me an overview of that.
Sure, absolutely. Let me just backpedal just real quick. It was, right, we did Royal Arch, and then the final chapter of that book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, I was talking about, like, Masonic symbolism in film, and this is a really interesting subject for me, so I published the first book on cinema symbolism was just called Cinema Symbolism. That came out a couple years ago, and I just released Cinema Symbolism 2. This book came out a couple months ago. It's the sequel to Cinema Symbolism, and I take on a whole slate of new movies. In the first movie book, I talked about things like The Exorcist and The Matrix and Star Wars, mm-hmm. and Wizard of Oz. In this one, we get into some of the spaghetti Western movies of Sergio Leone. We get into the Harry Potter films, some of the works of David Lynch, Stephen King's The Shining, of course, made by Stanley Kubrick, Eyes Wide Shut. A whole slate of brand new movies, some new topics I talk about in Cinema Symbolism 2. One thing that was really, you know, was unique that I kind of discovered when I was writing the first movie book. You know, the books really deal with, like, arcane themes and symbols and numbers hidden in popular movies. One of the things I discovered that was going on, which is a really unique study, is the actual casting of actors and actresses for what I would call occult purposes, where the actual actor will bring sort of what I call their cultural valences to a particular movie. It's not typecasting. It's actually putting an actor in a film to sort of subdraw on an earlier performance kind of conjure imagery from an earlier film and place it in the new movie. That's really a fascinating study. So yeah, Cinema Symbolism 2 is out. It came out a couple months ago, and I'm real happy with it. And like I said, it's a whole new slate of movies that I analyzed.
Robert, who puts the symbolism in the movies? Is it the writer of the book that's turned into the movie? Is it the writer for the movie? Is it the director? Who puts them in there? And then why?
It's a great question. I find that it's usually a combination of the writers, it can be the producer, it can be the director. Some directors and producers are much more, it can be the art director. Some people are much more adroit with this than others. And why it is done, this is a really, you know, fascinating question. Certainly you can look at it as a form of manipulation. I see it more as what I call in both books, really modern day mythology making. If you've got a filmmaker who's really good with this, they know what they're doing, and a lot of times the symbolism reflects what's going on inside the movie. You get into things like the Star Wars films where you're dealing with the monomyth of Joseph Campbell, and this deals with ancient mythology. You know the tales of like Hercules and you know, Perseus, and it's just like a retelling of those ancient mythologies. So it's a form of modern day mythology making. And also it's a challenge. I think a lot of these filmmakers and these producers view it as almost like a game of chess they're playing with the audience. If a person is tuned into this, and this is again sort of my motivation for writing both books, if a person becomes tuned into this, you'll watch these movies with a whole new eye and see different things going on in the background, different storylines, what these guys are using to convey different meanings to your subconscious mind. So the motivations are many. It makes the movies, I think, much more interesting to watch. It makes them better, I think. Movies that do not have it are not necessarily bad per se, but it's definitely an added element to these films that makes them much more fascinating, much more interesting, and probably in the end makes the studio a lot more money.
Robert, is the symbolism noticeable, or do you really have to look for it?
Depends on the film and it's some are more on the surface than others. Some are very well hidden, and it can be much more difficult to pick up on. Usually when I start notice, you know, my methodology is when I watch a film and I first kind of start seeing this material being presented, it's dissecting the context of the film. Am I dealing with an alchemical movie? Am I dealing with a Gnostic movie? Am I dealing with something that deals with the monomyth? Am I what's going on in the film? Am I dealing with archetypal imagery? If so, what sort of archetypes? And then it's, you know, watching the film over and over again. Believe me when I tell you, I watch certain films and I'm still picking up on stuff to this day. So watching it in a movie theater really doesn't cut it. I have to have it in Blu-ray where I can pause it, jump around in the film. That's critical to this. Some are very well hidden. I can give you examples, but some are on the surface. And again, it just goes to the level of the filmmaker, how well versed they are, and the levels can vary.
Indeed. Now, since you've been doing this, and what got you into this in the first place?
Yeah, it really goes back to, that's a great question. It goes back to writing the first book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, and it goes back to the early 2000s. There was a string of Gnostic movies that came out in the late 1990s, notably The Matrix, Fight Club, and The Truman Show. These movies are essentially really showing you on screen a lot of the theology associated with a early Christian, you know, esoteric Christian movement called Gnosticism. And then in the early 2000s, you had a movie come out called National Treasure. This was put out by the Disney studios, and a lot of people aren't aware of this. You watch the movie on its surface, and it has these sort of Masonic overtones in it, where they're looking for this lost treasure of the Templars, the Freemasons. What people weren't aware of, and this is what I was writing the Royal Arch of Enoch book, is that movie, that first National Treasure movie, is actually a Masonic ritual on screen. That is the Masonic Royal Arch of Enoch ritual presented on screen. The ritual is about the recovery and restoration of the lost Masonic treasure in a subterranean treasure vault Beneath the Holy Ground. And of course, what's the National Treasure movie? Well, it's just that. It's the restoration, recovery of this Knights Templar treasure in a subterranean vault beneath the Holy Ground. They put it in New York City in the ritual. It's the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And the reason it's in New York City, and I get into this more in the book, it has to do with a Freemason named DeWitt Clinton, who was the former mayor of New York City, mm-hmm. former governor of New York State. But anyway, that movie was like, oh my God. I mean, you know, there is a Freemasonic ritual right there on the big screen for everyone to see. And I talked about that movie in the first book, The Royal Arch of Enoch. And this was just something that I just really wanted to delve into much, much more in depth. And Royal Arch was, good grief, almost 700 pages long. So I started writing Cinema Symbolism, which was my first movie book, and that documented, you know, analyzed movies, like I said, sort of like The Wizard of Oz, which is, you know, the guy who wrote the, you asked me about the writer, is the writer doing anything? The guy who wrote The Wizard of Oz was a man named L. Frank Baum, who was in Madame Blavatsky's Theosophy Society. So you will find these decidedly theosophical overtones in The Wizard of Oz. The Matrix films, which are, again, very Gnostic. Fight Club, which is very Gnostic. The Star Wars movies. I took apart all six of them in the first cinema book, which is the Camel Monomyth. So, yeah, that's what really got me interested and, you know, did Cinema Symbolism, and there were more movies I wanted to talk about, so out came Cinema Symbolism too.
And Robert, was there a common denominator with these movies? We're going to get into these movies in our second half of our interview here with you, but sure. Was there a common denominator in these movies of this symbolism?
I would say my answer to that question would be no. Each movie has to be looked at in its own context. That's really the best way I can answer it. I wouldn't say there's a common denominator. Like you take the National Treasure movie, A Veiled Masonic Ritual. You take a movie such as The Shining, Repetition. That movie is just nothing but repetition over and over again. Kubrick is doing that in purpose to literally bombard your subconscious mind with this endless vicious reincarnation cycle going on inside the Overlook. But then you fast forward to another movie that Kubrick did, like Eyes Wide Shut. He uses occult techniques in that, but they're not repetition. So he goes to something else. So no, I would not say there is a common denominator. It's the context of the movie, and that's really what gets into, that's really, for me, is discovering the context of the esoterica or the arcana in the film. Once that is identified by me, the unveiling of it and the discovering of what's going on inside of it becomes much more, easier for me to analyze.
And is there truth behind all of this, or is this Hollywood?
Oh, no, there's truth behind all this. I mean, these people are definitely doing this on purpose. What I argue in the book, what I theorize in the book is I believe this is intentionally done. But what I do argue is certainly, you know, I'm a lawyer, so I've always trained that there's no such thing as a coincidence. But what happens?
That's a good point. I say that all the time, Robert, the time.
It's a great question you're asking, is what happens when you get into a scenario, and I have confronted this, where you have a movie and a film that is presenting this imagery, but the filmmaker was clearly ignorant of the material he's presenting. How do you account for that? What I theorize in the book is I turn to the works of Carl Gustav Jung, who was a famous psychiatrist. He talked about this thing called the collective unconscious, and that there was these archetypal imageries, mythology, ancient religions, occult themes that were basically buried in our subconscious mind, and that because filmmaking is an artistic expression, they may come out in the film regardless of the filmmaker's intent. This is not as a stretch as you may sound. This was actually put forward originally by the Greek philosopher Plato. He called it the theory of forms. And if the idea behind it is that if you're making an artistic expression, you may be incorporating this arcana subconsciously and not even aware of it. That being said, I do believe in most instances, and certainly in the ones I talk about in the book, this is very intentionally done.
Was there anybody better than another for symbolism in movies? Was Kubrick, for example, better than someone else?
I think Kubrick is, Kubrick is great, but like you turn to like something like The Shining, which is overloaded with stuff. Eyes Wide Shut is overloaded with stuff. But then you get into something like Barry Lyndon, not so much. Kubrick is very good at it. Darren Aronofsky is very good at it. Robert Zemeckis is very good at it. George Lucas with the monomyth with Joseph Campbell.
What about Spielberg? Is he into that?
Yeah, Spielberg a little bit, sure. I'll go for Spielberg. But yeah, again, it's again another one. Martin Scorsese does some. I mean, again, it's the movie. Scorsese, you take something like Taxi Driver, not so much, but then you get into a movie with Gangs of New York, very religious, a lot of buried Roman Catholic themes. These are themes you will find in the spaghetti westerns of Sergio Leone, again, very intentional. So some guys are better than others, and I guess the point I'm trying to make...
They are geniuses, though, at what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you, but I totally agree. But what I would say is, what makes them genius about it is they incorporate it or place it in some movies and not others. They know when to use it, when not to use it, and they know they don't use the same techniques in all their films. That's what makes it really genius, and that's what even makes it a little more difficult to pick up on.
And sometimes you have to watch these movies several times before you get the symbolism.
Oh, you're telling me. My goodness gracious.
That happened to me with Eyes Wide Shut. I didn't get it the first time, but the more I watched it, the more I saw these different things.
Oh, there is no doubt about that. And that's why I said you really can't, for me at any rate, I can only speak for myself, I couldn't do this in a movie theater, in a darkened movie theater, making notes. I mean,
it's impossible.
It's impossible. I mean, I make 5 or 6 pages of notes, and you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the films that I took on in Cinema Symbolism was the Darren Aronofsky movie, Black Swan. There's so much going on inside that. And I'll just say this real quick. When I talk about it again in Cinema Symbolism too, but there was something in that I noticed that I should have put in the first time around, but I missed it. And I can't tell you how many times I'll be sitting there writing and thinking to myself, what happened in that scene? It's like, oh my God, now I got to go back and watch it and throw the Blu-ray in and cue it up. And absolutely, got to watch the thing more than once, no question about it.
Amazing work. We'll get into the specifics of the movies, Robert, right after the break here. The name of the book is Cinema Symbolism 2. Where do you get the book, Robert?
You can get it on all the online sellers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. It's on in the ebook form, Kindle, Nook. All the major online retailers have it, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. You can get it if you're listening overseas. The overseas sites have it as well. Apple iBookstore also has it.
How did you get the symbolism for these movies? Did you have to go out and dig this up, or were there other sources for you?
Well, it really was. That's a great question. It was when I was writing Royal Arch of Enoch. That was a product of 20 years of research and investigating the occult and Masonic symbolism and secret societies. And essentially, George, what I did was I turned that 20 years of research onto Hollywood, and the symbolisms that I was dissecting and analyzing in Royal Arch of Enoch, whether it be architecture or a city plan, a streetscape, or a state seal or a college seal or a university seal, I turned that symbolism on Hollywood and used this occult research to pick apart movies.
Well, you did a great job doing it, Robert. It's a great book, and the graphic on the cover is fantastic. Who did that for you? The publisher?
No, I designed that.
You did? Good job.
Yeah, thank you very much. I design all the covers of my books. Thank you very much.
All right, well, stick with us. We're going to come back in a moment. Robert W. Sullivan IV, Cinema Symbolism 2. In the last hour, where we take your phone calls, check in with us on the movies and also movies that you think you've seen some symbolism, and tell us what you think about that. We'll be back in a moment with more on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Robert Sullivan with us. We'll take phone calls with Robert next hour. Robert, let's begin with National Treasure. Tell us about the symbolism in that movie and what it all means.
Yeah, you're actually watching with National Treasure a Masonic ritual. That is the Royal Arch of Enoch ceremonial, and this was one of the movies that really tipped me off to the symbolism. The Royal Arch of Enoch ritual, just real quickly, is part of the high degree system of Freemasonry. It is the 13th degree in the Scottish Rite. It is the 7th degree in the York Rite. It is part of the High Degrees. It is not part of the Blue Lodge, which is degrees 1, 2, and 3. And the ritual documents the recovery of this subterranean treasure vault in which is the what is known as the Tetragrammaton, which is the name of God from which all wisdom derives from. And this is part of the high degree system. The ritual, the first temple, the Temple of Solomon, which is what the Blue Lodge revolves around, that temple's been destroyed. They're building the second temple on the Temple Mount, known as the Temple of Zorobabel. And a trap door is sprung, and a subterranean treasure vault is discovered, and it is beneath 9 arches that this treasure, these 2 pillars that contain this Enochian wisdom is inscribed upon, is discovered with the name of God. This is essentially the National Treasure movie, where it's the search for this lost Masonic Knights Templar treasure, and they move the subterranean treasure vault to New York City. In the ritual, it's the holy ground, it's the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, but in the movie, it is in New York City. And this is a clear reference to a Mason, a Freemason by the name, a very important one, named DeWitt Clinton, who has been all but written off of our history books. He is really the driving force behind using Freemasonry and its philosophies and its teachings and its symbols to cultivate and craft the United States around. Most people know George Washington and Ben Franklin and the Founding Fathers. It is DeWitt Clinton who is really the driving force after Washington dies in 1799 that is using Masonry to nation build. And you will find his fingerprints all over the place with things like the Erie Canal and Union College. But at any rate, getting back to the movie, so National Treasure is a Masonic ritual. It is the recovery of this Knights Templar treasure in a subterranean treasure vault beneath the holy ground. And that is exactly what is happening in the movie. So if you want to see a Masonic ritual on the big screen, look no further than the first National Treasure movie.
Next one, of course, Numbers in Film. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is an interesting study. And this is, the numbers don't lie. So this is something that, you know, you can really pin down upon. And one of the great ones, I'll just get into this briefly. This was something I talked about in the first cinema book with, you get into the whole number thing with Back to the Future with the 88 miles an hour. There's a reason why that it's 88 miles an hour. And then you have the number 88 again in The Exorcist being used, but again for different purposes. Great numeric reference in the movie Black Swan, starring Natalie Portman and Winona Ryder. This movie came out a few years ago. This movie is overloaded with esoteric themes. You have tons of archetypal imagery in Black Swan. You have an entire alchemical storyline going on in that, where the ballerina is literally morphing into a Black Swan grotesque creature. She's actually performing alchemy in that movie. Numbers in Film. When Natalie Portman, this is a great one, and again, you can't tell me this is a coincidence. Watch Black Swan near the beginning of it, when Natalie Portman's character, Nina Sayers, she's getting off the subway train and she's going into the ballet company. You're going to see, she turns to the wall and there's a huge banner on the wall, and it features Winona Ryder on it. This is the ballerina who is sort of being forced out, forced into an early retirement.
Okay.
If you've seen it. Pay attention to the date on it. There's a date under Winona Ryder's image. It says February 12th. That's the date of the, the grand opening. That date is a reference to, is it the birth date of a very famous Russian ballerina named Anna Pavlova. She was born on February 12th, and she crafted a ballet around Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake known as the Dying Swan. And that is exactly what the Winona Ryder character is doing. She's suicidal. She's self-destructive. So that is a very, very, very well-hidden reference, little numerological reference.
Who thinks of this stuff?
Oh, I think it's the producers, it's the directors, and it's a game. It's a game they're playing. It's like I've said on other shows, it's, I feel like a lot of times when I'm watching these movies, I'm playing a symbolic game of chess against like a Bobby Fischer or something, because they're very good at this. And that one in Black Swan is just fantastic. And just real quickly, if you think I'm stretching this or something, watch the end credits of the film. Anna Pavlova, her ballet was called The Dying Swan. And again, it's on the poster we're there with Winona Ryder. If you watch the end credits of that movie, Winona Ryder is actually credited as Beth McIntyre, The Dying Swan. So there's no doubt about any of this. And they're very, like I said, they're very expert with it, and it can be very, very difficult to pick up upon.
Harry Potter films, you say they're loaded with symbolism.
Yeah, the Harry Potter films are great. I dissect all seven of them in the book, or excuse me, there's seven novels, there's eight films because they broke Deathly Hallows in half. Each one of those is a microcosm of the Joseph Campbell monomyth, and it repeats over and over again. They get into, the supernatural. You know, if you're familiar with the Joseph Campbell monomyth, if the listener is not, Joseph Campbell was an American mythologist, and he wrote a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and he dissects and he lists these elements that are critical to mythology telling. One of them is like call to adventure and supernatural aid and meeting with the goddess, which is the introduction of the sacred feminine. You will find all these components in the Harry Potter films. The one that's very interesting and that's kind of Freemasonic is, and this ties into what we were just talking about, George, was with the National Treasure movie, this high degree ritual. Let me just give a bit of a backstory on this. I'll do it as fast as I can. The high degree Royal Arch of Enoch ceremonial being the recovery of the subterranean treasure vault. It's the seventh degree in the York Rite. It's the 13th in the Scottish Rite. The underlying mythology of this ritual is before the Masons discover it, the treasure vault is penetrated by two mythological figures. Well, one's mythological, one's historical. The treasure vault is penetrated by a character known as Hermes Trismegistus. He's sort of this god of magic figure, and he pronounces the Tetragrammaton and restores the seven liberal arts and sciences. The other figure is Pythagoras. The Hermes Trismegistus character, this is a very archetypal character. He turns up in films all the time. It's the god of magic. It's the wizard figure. Think Albus Dumbledore. Think Obi-Wan Kenobi. Think Gandalf the Grey. And what's interesting is how this actually ties into Harry Potter, because you have this Hermes Trismegistus character, Albus Dumbledore. Again, think the hermit card of the tarot. You go to the very first Harry Potter film, Sorcerer's Stone, and you have this Hermes Trismegistus archetype, this wizard archetype. And what does he have? Well, he has a subterranean vault in Gringotts, the bank. I mean, and what's the number of the bank? I mean, you know, what's the degree? It's the seventh degree in the York Rite. It's the 13th degree in the Scottish Rite, this Royal Arch ceremonial. So what's Dumbledore's vault number? I mean, it's 713 of all things. You can't make this stuff up. And it is just uncanny that the length that these people will go to bury this mythology and this arcana in these films. And it's like I said, it's just a fascinating study for me. Good stuff, though.
The seeing eye in the dollar that was also a National Treasure, what does that represent?
Yeah, this is, you're talking this would be the obverse seal of the great, of the United States. This is,
On the back of the dollar bill, right?
Right, this is the back of the dollar bill, the truncated pyramid with the all-seeing eye, Annuitus Keptus, thus begins the new order of the ages. You get a lot of interpretation of this thing. With pyramids and Egypt, you have a deep Masonic tie-in to Egypt. You can find this in the works of Martin Clare, of James Anderson. You get into things like nation building, architecture. So, of course, you always tie into the pyramids. The all-seeing eye is generally, you'll find this on Masonic documents all over the place. It goes back to the Renaissance. It's a symbol of deity. It's the eye of providence. It's just a symbol for deity. In Masonry, this is known as the great architect of the universe. What's interesting with the Great Seal, though, is you will find on the seal, both on the obverse and the reverse, the number 13 incorporated all over the place, with the 13 arrows, the 13 fig leaves, the 13 berries. And again, in my research, and this is something I present in the Royal Arch of Enoch book, is that number 13 is referencing this 13th degree in the Scottish Rite, the Royal Arch of Enoch, the recovery of the Tetragrammaton, the name of God, which you will find again on screen in the very first National Treasure film.
Amazing work. It truly is. Let's talk about Kubrick again now. Eyes Wide Shut, then we'll come into The Shining again. I thought Eyes Wide Shut, after I saw it three or four times, was a great movie. Kubrick died before he finished it, didn't he?
He died. I think he finished it, but he died right before it came out. I think he died just a couple of months.
I think he died before it was finally edited.
Yeah, you could be right. You definitely could be right there. I know he died before it was finally released. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting film, to say the least. That and The Shining are two that I definitely analyzed in Cinema Symbolism too.
I mean, there's no question. He was trying to get across a message that the Illuminati, the globalists, are weird. They do different things. They have their own, you know, they beat to a different drum. But what other symbolism did he try to leak into that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You have the global puppeteers, the Illuminati, in the mansion doing the sex magic rituals.
Which I bet they really do.
Yeah, well, this is talked about in the works of people like Aleister Crowley. You have groups like the OTO, This Is No State Secret, performing sex magic, this Kundalini, esoterica. I totally agree with that. What I really liked what he did in that movie, which is very symbolic, is he uses a similar technique in Barry Lyndon, but doesn't use it for the same reason. What you have in Eyes Wide Shut is he uses the Christmas lights. He sets this movie at Christmas time, and he uses these glaring, gaudy Christmas lights, and they're in every scene in that movie. And whenever these Christmas lights appear, it's always something negative going on. He's showing you the ills of society. It's, you know, whether it's child pornography or drug addiction or prostitution or homelessness. It's always the ills of society,
right,
that he's shoving in your face with these gaudy, glowing Christmas lights. But then the Tom Cruise character gets to the Illuminati sex magic ritual globalist party in the mansion, and there is no Christmas lights. They're nowhere to be found. And what Kubrick is doing symbolically by doing that is he's showing you, you know, if you think the ills of that are plaguing mankind are, you know, bad, that's nothing compared to what these guys are up to.
Was there any symbolism when they were in their costumes at that event?
Yeah, I thought there was. If you pay attention to it, they have the Venetian masks on. There's symbolism with that. He's kind of reversing it. A lot of the mask symbolism ties into Christian festivities surrounding Mardi Gras. Of course, now they're using them for diabolical purposes, so it's sort of a reversal with the masks. If you pay attention to, my goodness gracious, I mean, how could I forget this? When the, this is a great one, a lot of people don't notice this one. When Red Cloak, the master of ceremonies, there's two things going on with him. Pay attention to his chair. It has the double-headed eagle on it. I mean, of course, this is conjuring the Scottish Rite, the high degree, so he's kind of, you know, in a position of authority.
And a staff he had or something.
And then the other thing that's great with this is when he's with the women, the naked women, and he's casting the circle. The magic circle is big time in witchcraft and the occult and symbolism. And he actually refers back to this at the very end of the movie when Tom Cruise and Nicole and the little girl in the toy store, at the very end of it, they pass by a game. It's a stack of games, says the magic circle. And then Red Cloak earlier on in the movie is casting the magic circle with the incense. Pay attention to this because he's casting it backwards. He's casting it. This is what in the occult is known as Widdershins. And he's moving counterclockwise. That's black magic. If you cast the circle clockwise in the motion of the sun, that's white magic.
All right.
But if you cast it backwards, that's black magic.
And wasn't that that little saying, whatever he was doing, that was backwards as well?
Yeah, well, you have the music that's playing in the background, which is...
chant was weird.
Yeah, the chant is a... I talk about this in the book. I'm glad you brought that up. The chant is a Gregorian chant that is being played backwards. It's very morbid. It's very eerie. I say in the book that it's actually conjuring in your subconscious mind the Exorcist movie, where the little girl is speaking English backwards. And again, by doing that, by playing that music backwards, that Gregorian chant backwards, it's evil. And again, that was in The Exorcist, when they're speaking backwards, that's, you know, demonism, devil worship, you know, that's when the little girl is possessed by the devil. So by doing that, yeah, it's again investing that ritual with black magic and demonism works for great effect.
It was a great movie. I mean, just everything was thought out in the way the people that he would work with in their day-to-day existence, he had no idea that's who they were under those masks.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have the, and then at the very end of it, when Sidney Pollack is telling him, hey, the Illuminati's real, he's doing it, I like this, I thought this worked with great effect. He's playing pool, and the pool table is not green, it's red. And that's actually drawing back to the ritual, which is on a red carpet. And that was really, I felt, done with great effect, because he's telling you kind of, yeah, hey, this is real. You know, this wasn't a joke. I mean, you know, what I'm telling you is the truth. I thought that was really good.
We'll get into The Shining. We'll get into The Lion King, believe it or not. That had some overtones and a few other things. And we'll take your phone calls next with Robert Sullivan IV as we talk about Cinema Symbolism 2, Strange Things in Movies. But I'm sure they're all over the place. And that's one thing we'll ask you, Robert, when we come back. Beyond movies, the symbolism must be everywhere. So we'll check into that. Don't forget, folks, to like us at Facebook, follow us at Twitter, and send me an email whenever you need to at George@coast2coastam.com.